Hello, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm Linda Palacio, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Today we have a very special guest talking about a very specific region of cooking and food. And somehow, I don't know, I always think of this food during the summertime, I guess, because, you know, you go to a big party and someone says, oh, we're having a fish boil, or we're having a low country boil. So what we're going to talk about is low country cuisine, kind of a fuzzy term to a lot of people. And our guest has been called the preeminent and the eminent authority on low country cuisine, John Martin Taylor, otherwise known as Hoppin' John. Welcome, John.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for having me on.
First of all, I think we would like to have you describe what is low country and where is low country.
Well, the low country is the coastal plain of South Carolina and Georgia, and it runs from the first of the barrier islands, which begin to the north, just south of Myrtle Beach, just south of the North Carolina border. Mm-hmm. They're barrier islands. They actually run all the way down into northern Florida. And so it's this low, flat coastal plain. It runs about 80 miles inland, 70 or 80 miles inland. Actually, it used to all be underwater at one time when the ocean was in. So it's the coastal plain, but it's also, I mean, geographically that's where it is. But it's also the land that was settled by Europeans in the late 17th century, the land between Charleston and Savannah, Georgia, Charleston, South Carolina, mm-hmm. and Savannah, Georgia. Charleston was settled in 1670. Mm-hmm. So it's got a very peculiar history.
Yeah, and where would you be from?
I grew up about 70 miles inland, but my folks had a boat down on the coast, and so I spent a lot of time on that boat.
Your accent does tell.
Well, you know, it's funny. Actually, my accent is Georgia. I went to school in Georgia. Ah. Both my parents were scientists. We weren't from South Carolina. We moved there when I was three from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. So I moved from one coastal plain to another. And the food actually was very similar because the cooking in the low country is Creole cooking. It was actually the first Creole cuisine in America.
Well, you say, you know, this land that was settled by Europeans who came, but then they have a very interesting history post that time, which forms the food, the low country cuisine that we know, which would be, you tell us about that.
Well, to begin with, you need to know a little bit of the history. The Carolina was settled, was land given to a bunch of rich guys down on Barbados they were second and third sons of the aristocracy, and you know, go back to the earlier part of the 17th century, and Charles I had been beheaded, and so these sympathizers, these friends of the crown, had left, and they'd gone to Barbados, and they'd raised a bunch of money, and of course the guy with the most money wins, and they restored Charles II to the throne, and as a thank you, they gave these eight guys all of the land south of Virginia, which they named Carolina after Charles, mm-hmm. Latin for Charles. And so they came from Barbados, where with a plantation model, they had raised all this money, they had become extremely wealthy in sugar and rum production. And so they came to South Carolina to make more money, to fuel both the crown and their extravagant lifestyles. And they quickly found that rice was going to be the crop that was going to be best for the subtropical climate and terrain there. But, of course, they knew nothing about rice cookery. Mm-hmm. And so they began to import slaves from West African rice-growing lands. By 1708, very early on, Charleston was founded in 1670, by mm-hmm. 1708 there was a black majority. And so this West African majority had a major influence on the cooking, because the white men who came, they were mostly English and French. The white men who came prior to these plantations knew nothing about rice cookery. they still, English and French, really still don't know much about rice cookery, right. Actually. But there, these men who settled in South Carolina, they were very clever, and they hired the great English philosopher John Locke to write a constitution for them. And in that constitution, he had religious freedom was granted, and this was, you know, this is something that others had talked about here and there, but it was actually the first place in the world where this was actually put into law.
Huh.
And this happened coincidentally as Protestants and Jews throughout Europe were being persecuted yet again, and so Charleston and the Low Country became a haven for these people who were suffering from religious persecution. And so they fled to South Carolina, such that by the middle of the 18th century, half of the white population were French Huguenots.
I was going to say that kind of explains some of the things you see on Low Country cuisine menus. You know, the Huguenot
yes,
tort, and I'm thinking, why? Where'd that come from?
And the desserts, the sauces.
Mm-hmm.
But not only were there French Huguenots, the Low Country gentry early on learned that they didn't want to use their land for animal husbandry, and they were getting cheese and they're getting dairy products and getting wheat from Pennsylvania and from England, having it come shipped in, and they thought this is ridiculous, so they offered this land about 70 miles inland in Orangeburg to Lutherans from the Palatinate. So they came, and they brought with them great, you know, meat curing skills, and they raised the dairy cattle for them and the wheat, and incidentally that part of the state is still the center of dairy production in the state. Jews came, but they were Sephardic Jews. And,
mm-hmm.
and Charleston had the largest Jewish population in the New World until the Industrial Revolution brought the hordes of Eastern Europeans to the Northeast. But they were Sephardic Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And so they came from the Mediterranean with this great love of things that weren't being eaten elsewhere in the colonies, such as pasta and tomatoes. They sun-dried tomatoes, their recipes in their old books. And eggplant, which were also popular in West Africa. So you have West Africans, you have English second sons of and third sons of the aristocracy, you have French Huguenots, you have Lutherans, and you can see it in the foods.
Interesting. Well, and we're going to talk about those foods more in a moment. But so is Gullah the African or West Indian? What is the Gullah culture that is talked about?
Well, Gullah. When I was growing up, Gullah was never used to refer to people. It was purely the language.
Yeah.
Because the West Africans came from some 40 tribes, and they spoke 40 dialects.
Hmm.
And of course, they weren't allowed to read or write, and so a common language emerged, which is called Gullah. Interestingly, it's important to know that by 1720, more than half of the settlers, both black and white, had first who came to Charleston via the Caribbean. So they were already somewhat creolized. Actually,
uh-huh.
they were already extremely creolized in manners and customs and language, and in the way they prepared foods.
Well, it's interesting because I when I was looking through I failed to mention about your books. John is the author of 4 cookbooks, the most recent, which isn't all that recent, but the one that is still, I think, the tome and the resource for most people wanting to know about this cuisine is called Hoppin' John's Low Country Cuisine. And in looking through some of the recipes in that, I mean, you see, it's evident when you read through the recipes, you can see all these different really different cultures coming through, and with strange names as well.
And your strange names.
And for those who aren't aware about what Hoppin' John is, and you took the name Hoppin' John, tell us about Hoppin' John and how you took that name.
Well, Hoppin' John is sort of the. It really, in the end, it all comes down to Hoppin' John. It is a simple bean and rice. Perlo, as we say. Perlo is, most people would say pilaf or pilo or pilau. Or there's many pronunciations in Charleston. You also hear perlo, but it's a bean and rice dish seasoned with smoked pork and enlivened with hot peppers. The dish came from West Africa. It's a great example of low country cooking because the red peas, which are Vigna unguiculata, is the Latin. It's the black-eyed peas.
Black-eyed
but
peas,
but there are
right.
dozens and dozens and hundreds, actually, of varieties of Vigna. But they came from Africa. The rice came from Africa. The smoked pork is a legacy of European butchers. The hot peppers from the Caribbean. You have the cornbread that goes alongside it. That's a throwback to both the Scots-Irish breads and Native American corn, and then you have collards also from West Africa that accompany it all. That's more pure Africa. You know, it's just, and then we serve it on New Year's Day for good luck, along with a ham or roast pork, with a host of condiments, which, you know, reflect all these exotic flavors that Charleston Harbor brought into the South along with the enslaved. I think of our condiments a lot as the real hallmark of the cuisine, and that those tastes move inland with the plantation model, as Charlestonians and their ilk began to settle throughout the South.
Yeah, it's interesting because when you think of one who's not from the area thinks of low country cuisine, of course we think of a shrimp and grits or a low country boil, a fish boil or the she crab soup or something, but we don't really think of the condiments. We don't think of those things.
You have black-eyed peas, field peas, cow peas, crowder peas. You have all of these peas, or butter beans for that matter, which civvy beans.
Like lima beans, right?
Baby little lima beans. You have any of these throughout the South served alongside a pork roast. In the low country, those beans are put on top of the rice, and it's served with a pear relish, for example. And that makes the dish low country right there.
Interesting. That's great.
The condiments are a very important part of it. And, you know, back to shrimp, and let's go to shrimp and grits, since you brought it up. You know, shrimp and grits is actually, you know, what most people think of as the defining dish of the low country table.
Right.
But when I moved to Charleston in 1986 to open my culinary bookstore, shrimp and grits were not being served in a single restaurant in the low country. And in fact, it was almost impossible to find stone ground, whole grain, heirloom corn products in the state. You might find them, you know, in a health food store sitting on an unrefrigerated shelf with no milling date.
Well, you helped that situation out,
well,
didn't you?
Well, I did. And the only, I don't take full credit, but the only restaurant I knew of anywhere serving shrimp and grits was Bill Neal's Crook's Corner in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He was something of a culinary historian, too. I mean, when I was growing up, this is a breakfast dish made with bacon grease and the tiny little creek shrimp. Of course, dinner back then was in the middle of the day, and supper and breakfast were interchangeable meals. So this sort of Italian-style polenta-like dish with big shrimp was not typical back then at all. But, you know, I'm really proud to say that, you know, for the past 25 years, I've been trying to restore a cuisine that was basically dead when I moved back home.
Well, that was for the second part of the show that I want to address the fact, is there really low country cuisine anymore?
Yeah.
But before that, I wanted to tell people that, because you brought up the, you know, the shrimp and grits and the cornmeal, you have a website, hoppinjohns.com, where you sell heirloom cornmeal and grits and what, hominy? Do you sell hominy or?
I don't sell hominy, although that's Charleston has always been like New Orleans. It's always been its own place. if you say hominy in Charleston to old timers, hominy means cooked grit. So it's not, it's funny. Hominy is, of course, corn that's been, originally it was soaked in lye.
Right.
And to de-germinate it, there's two ways you can de-germinate corn. You can do it chemically, or you can do it physically by just grinding it and sifting the tough parts out, which have the germ, but the germ is where the oil is, and we all know that fat's what carries flavor, and so you don't want to get rid of that. And it's very interesting because hominy and hominy grits developed in the Southeast and in the Southwest. You know, there were hominy grits in the southeastern United States, and in the southwestern United States, they did the same thing
Texas, you think of it as a lot of Texans.
Well, or Native Americans with their pozole and their masa harina to make tamales with, and the reason it developed is because, sort of complicated, but the reason it developed is to make it last during the winter. Because once you grind corn that's whole grain, the germ with the oil in it is exposed to the air, and then the oil will go rancid.
Right.
And in the low country, they didn't even have stones to grind with, and so they traded with Indians from the Native Americans from Appalachia. And the corn I sell is actually an Appalachian traditional heirloom. I use three or four varieties.
It's all in close proximity there. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk more about some of the specific dishes that you describe in your book. So we'll be back in a moment, okay? Are back and happy to say that today's show is being sponsored by Fairway Market, and we are talking with Hoppin' John Taylor, John Martin Taylor, culinary historian and author of cookbooks and expert on low country cuisine. So, John, I really wanted to ask you to describe some of the dishes that are really that you describe in your book and that you, I guess, have sort of reintroduced to a lot of people, like Frogmore stew and red rice. Well, red rice has never gone away. Red rice has been around, right? But what is red rice?
Red rice has never gone away, and it's never going to go away.
No.
And you find it. You find it wherever rice is grown. I mean, it's a variation of it. As long as there is a European influence too, you'll find rice and tomatoes cooked. It's interesting that you don't see it in Asian cooking more. But red rice throughout the Americas, any place the Spanish have been, any place the French have been, you're going to find red rice today. But rice dishes in general are really the defining dishes of the Low Country, what we call perlos, which are like jambalaya, actually.
Mm-hmm.
A shrimp perlo, a chicken perlo, any type of perlo. Dishes with, if you think, it's actually easier to think about the ingredients more than the actual dishes.
Right.
Because the ingredients are very specific. Rice to begin with. Grits, yes, not as much so, but rice certainly.
Yeah.
Okra. The great, my friend and great culinary scholar, Jessica Harris, she's the expert on the foods of the African diaspora, likes to say that wherever the finger of okra points, wherever you find Africans and their legacy, because okra is definitely one of those. Also, again, field peas, these cow peas, mm-hmm. these black-eyed peas. When I was growing up in the Lowcountry, there were over 300 varieties of cowpeas being grown. But by the time I opened my store, they were almost impossible to find. There were no urban farmers markets in mm-hmm. Charleston. It was sort of a culinary backwater. There were, you know, a couple of French restaurants, but a couple of Italian places.
Yeah.
But
well, you mentioned water, backwater, water. I mean, that region, a lot of what came of the dishes that developed, I mean, there's such a rich aquaculture there. I mean,
it's
seafood.
Amazing, the agriculture. It's subtropical, but even more importantly is this water. In the three counties into which modern Charleston sprawls, there are more than 500,000 acres of wetlands. And that includes, you know, former rice fields and swamps and marshes and rivers and streams and pine thickets and hardwood forests, but plus a fourth of the saltwater marshes on the east coast. And we have an 8-foot tide as well, so that's the biggest tide on the east coast until you get way up, you know, in northern Maine in the Bay of Nova Scotia, and they have those huge, huge ones. But 8 foot's a huge tide, and so that tide brings into these marsh grasses to feed and spawn the crabs and shrimp and oysters and clams and mullet and shad and bluefish and drums and mackerel and sturgeon, and all of these things entered the cooking from very early on. I talked to other culinary historians whose expertise lies in other areas, and sometimes people will say, well, what's the difference between the cooking here and the cooking in the Lowcountry and the cooking in, say, the Eastern Shore of Maryland or Tidewater, Virginia, or in New Orleans for that matter. But the big difference is in the makeup of the people and the touches that they brought and the food stuff that they didn't necessarily bring themselves, but that came with the trade. I mean, Charleston was so wealthy. These people were off and on. It was the richest city in America for 200 years. On any given day for 200 years, there were 200 boats in the harbor.
Wow.
Coconuts and bananas arrived from Cuba, which is a 4-day sail away. Mm-hmm. It's very
Nobody else had them, right?
It's still a 4-day sail away. But the interesting thing is that both coconut and banana cookery in the United States was led by Charlestonians, and the recipes are legion, and their journals are filled with them. Hundreds of recipes in both the printed literature. So if you look for banana cookery and pineapple cookery, it probably started in Charleston in America.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, and what about the Benny wafers are so...
Benny, again, ingredients. Benny is sesame seed, and both plant and word came with the enslaved from West Africa. And you see a lot of these ingredients and words staying. I mean, sorghum, field peas, okra. Okra is a West African word, as is gumbo, which also means okra. And even New World foods, such as peanuts and tomatoes and peppers, though all of them are New World, the West Africans were already well acquainted with them.
Hmm.
And their yams were very similar to New World sweet potatoes. And so...
So sweet potato pone, sweet potato pies, and
anything
breads,
sweet, right? Anything sweet potato, anything with crab, anything with benny seeds or okra, or sesame seeds, anything with okra or field peas, soups, stews, breads made with rice, breads made with corn, rice dishes, just like jambalaya, only different.
Well, Karen Hess did a great job of describing the jambalayas of the Purlaus in her South Carolina.
Yes, in her Carolina Rice Kitchen.
Right. That was great.
Karen was a dear, dear friend of mine. Dear friend of mine. When that book came out, she came to to Charleston, and it was, and I had a party for her in my bookstore, and it was one of those freaky early frosts, because in the Lowcountry we're subtropical, but you know, sometimes you get a frost as early as October, and sometimes you don't get one at all, and you pick, you know, Meyer lemons throughout the winter. But anyway, when I picked her up in the airport, I'd been quail hunting, and I had freshly shot quail hanging in the back of the truck, and I just let them hang there for several days in the cool, and then I remember I served them to her with spiced muscadines and with rice bread, and it was just the perfect meal.
Rice bread. What's rice bread?
Well, rice bread was the daily bread of Charleston for 200 years.
Would you put milled flour, milled rice flour,
no,
or the actual grain?
No, with the actual rice. Although they're in The Carolina Housewife, which was written by Sarah Rutledge, and published in 1847, she had over 30 rice breads. But when the Junior League published its famous Charleston Receipts, which is the longest standing fundraiser cookbook in America, is still in print, so thousands and thousands of copies. When it came out 100 years later in 1950, there wasn't a single recipe. The thing is that the rice, the middling rice, the broken up pieces of rice, was cheaper than wheat, which was all imported, even though they had it being grown for them in Orangeburg, 70 miles inland. And so they cooked rice and then added yeast and flour to it and made their bread. And it is an amazing bread that I tried and tried and tried to reintroduce to Charleston. I had a baker making it for me for a while. I felt sure the restaurants would pick up on it. But like the Perlos, they don't really do those either, because it's not something you can saute off, and it's not something that sits well on a steam table. So, although I have to say, I have to say, in defense of these young chefs who are now using the heirloom vegetables, some of this fancy stuff they're doing right now is actually a lot closer to the haute cuisine of Charleston, of antebellum Charleston. It's actually a lot closer. I think Henry Middleton would recognize some of Frank Lee's dishes of squab perlot and Bob Carter. I was just down there speaking at a corporate chef's conference, and Bob Carter had wrapped sweetbreads with little slivers of country ham and served it with a tomato jam. And that is, that fancy stuff is also typical of Lowcountry cooking, antebellum Lowcountry cooking, the stuff that disappeared. It has always been this high and low, this balance.
High and low.
Between
so Lowcountry, low on the culinary level, right?
Right. Well, they, you know,
but not taste-wise, for sure.
They were so wealthy. They were so well traveled. They went all over the world. They brought back, they brought back European taste, mostly European taste, and a lot of them were mimicking the French courts. I mean, when Sarah Rutledge published Carolina Housewife, she had, this is only 14 years after Carême's, the great you know, chef
Antonin Carême, right?
Yeah, the great chef, and he had been chef to Alexander in Russia, and had created Charlotte Russe for him, and here, 14 years after that, she's got two recipes for it in her book, and this is evidence that in Charleston kitchens, 14 years later, they're creating the finest European pastries in home kitchens.
Well, and when I asked you before our break that, you know, does Lowcountry cuisine still exist? Can you find it? And so you're saying, yes, you can. In the early 90s, I was producing, when the Food Network first started up, I was producing a restaurant show for the Food Network, and we wanted to do a show on Lowcountry cuisine. We had to send the camera crew out to Edisto Island. Is it Edisto? How does that
Edisto.
Edisto. Edisto. Edisto Island to find you know, any shootable, you know, filmable Lowcountry cooking.
It's taken quite a while. It's always existed where there's been no break with the land or water. So there are traditional dishes that that you will find at the homes of hunters, fishermen, and truck farmers.
Mm-hmm.
The low dishes, the common man's dishes like Hop and John, and pine bark stew, and chicken bogs, dishes like that, fish stews, that type of food.
Which Frogmore stew, for those people, Frogmore stew is really just a fish stew, right?
I mean, and Frogmore stew isn't a stew at all. And you know what? It's a relatively new thing.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's a relatively new thing. It's a New England boil. I mean, but it's not New England boil. It's a boil. You have corn, you have shrimp, and you have sausage. It's something you do. It's just
that's what. Yeah, when Northeasterners think of Low Country cuisine, oh, we'll have a Low Country boil, and it ends up, you know, it's just really basically a crab boil
or a clam bake, or whatever.
Right.
If when you live on the shore and you've got people with sausage and you've got corn,
lots of seafood,
and you've got seafood, it's what you do.
Yeah.
If you want to eat outside. But the really fancy dishes, the jellied meat dishes, the dobes and the perlos, they're the ones that are complicated. And the complicated desserts, they're the things that have really disappeared that you really can't find.
Mm. Now some of the desserts we talked about the sweet potato.
The simple things you can find, but the architectural 19th century things they disappeared, you know, after the Civil War. Everything about the culture changed after the Civil War.
Mm.
Not only were the men, the young men in the South, killed off, but they lost their lands, and the powerfully wealthy white men lost their lands coincidentally as railroads and refrigeration were coming into being. And also rice, which had been, the whole economy had been based mostly on rice. Rice was being planted in Arkansas and Louisiana and Texas and California, coincidentally as heavy planting and harvesting machinery, which was too much competition for the hand labor back in South Carolina, and it was too heavy for the low country soil. That machinery was introduced, so rice was gone, and with it a whole way of life, because the low country was rice.
Well, we can try to recreate it as best we can, especially from the recipes that you've included in your book, help people sort of kind of recapture what some of those dishes and what the life might have been like. And I would like to mention that John will be speaking, he'll be giving a lecture in Monticello at the Historic Plant Symposium, along with lots of great people that they have there, on September 10th and 11th. And on September 29th, you're presenting a lecture, a Low Country Evening with a Tasting of Low Country Fare at the Smithsonian.
Yes.
That's great. And you're going to be up our way on October 2nd.
Yes, I'm going to be at Pig Island.
Out at the Food and Beer Fest on Governor's Island, yeah. Okay, terrific. Well, thank you so much, John. If anyone wants to hear more, they can go to your website, Hoppin' John's, and you have a blog as well, or they can get out to one of these events that you're going to be presenting. I thank you very much for spending this time with us. And
it's been great chat.
Thank you. And I like to thank Fairway Market for being our sponsor today. I'm Linda Palacio. You've been listening to A Taste of the Past.